and grandiose, lacking remorse or guilt, deceitful and manipulative, impulsive, in need of excitement, lacking responsibility, emotionally shallow. Many errors in predicting behavior come from the belief that others will perceive things as we do. The psychopath described above will not. To successfully predict his behavior, you must see a situation your way and his way. It will be easy, of course, to see it your way. That's automatic. Seeing a situation from another person's perspective is an acquired skill. But you've already acquired it. Imagine that you're about to fire someone whose behavior, personality, and philosophy of life could not be further from your own. Even with all the differences, you would still know if he'd view the firing as fair, completely unfair, part of a vendetta, or motivated by discrimination or greed, etc. Particularly if you worked closely with this person, you could recite his perception of events much as he would. Though you may not share his view, you can still bring it into focus. Predicting human behavior is really about recognizing the play from just a few lines of dialogue. It's about trusting that a character's behavior will be consistent with his perception of the situation. If the play is true to humanness, each act will follow along as it should, as it does in nature. Imagine that you're watching a bird as it floats to earth, about to land. The sun is casting the bird's shadow on the ground, and both bird and shadow move toward the landing point. We know that the bird can't possibly arrive there before its shadow. Likewise, human action cannot land before impulse, and impulse cannot land before that which triggers it. Each step is preceded by the step before it. You cannot shoot the gun without first touching it, nor take hold of it without first intending to, nor intend to without first having some reason, nor have a reason without first reacting to something, nor react to something without first giving it meaning, and on and on. At many points before aiming a gun and pulling the trigger, particularly if the context is not unique, there are thoughts and emotions that others in similar situations also experienced. Think of any situation that many have shared, say, getting to an airport late, but not too late, for a flight. Based on your experience, you can predict some of the thoughts, emotions, and thus behaviors of a harried traveler. Is he likely to stroll? At the ticket counter, will he cordially allow others to get in line ahead of him? Will he savor the interesting architecture of the airport? Because we're familiar with the airport situation, we find it easy to predict what the traveler will do. It's precisely because some people are not familiar with violent behavior that they feel they can't predict it. Yet they daily predict nonviolent behavior, and the process is identical. In his book, Information Anxiety, Richard Saul Wurman explains that we recognize all things by the existence of their opposite. Day as distinguishable from night, failure from success, peace from war. We could add, safety from hazard. When a woman is comfortable with a stranger in her home, someone delivering furniture, for example, her comfort communicates that she has already predicted that he is not dangerous to her. Her intuition asked and answered several questions in order to complete that prediction. It evaluated favorable and unfavorable aspects of his behavior. Since we're more familiar with favorable behaviors, if you list them and then simply note their opposites, you will be predicting dangerousness. We call this the rule of opposites, and it is a powerful predictive tool. Favorable, unfavorable. Does his job and no more. Offers to help on unrelated tasks. Respectful of privacy. Curious, asks many questions. Stands at an appropriate distance. Stands too close. Waits to be escorted. Walks around the house freely. Keeps his comments to the job at hand. Tries to get into discussions on other topics. Makes personal comments. Mindful of the time, works quickly. No concern about time, in no hurry to leave. Doesn't care if others are home. Wants to know if others are home. Doesn't care if others are expected. wants to know if others are expected. Doesn't pay undue attention to you. Stares at you. All types of behavioral predictions, not just those about danger, can be improved by applying the rule of opposites. Just as we can predict behavior once we know the situation or context, we can also recognize the context by the behavior. A man insists on being first in the ticket line at the airport, looks frequently at his watch, appears exasperated by the slowness of the ticket agent. After getting his ticket, he runs awkwardly along, carrying his bags. He appears rushed and stressed. He looks expectantly at each gate he approaches. Is he A, a politician seeking votes who will stop and chat with each passerby? B, a charity volunteer who will solicit donations? C, a person late for his flight who will proceed directly to the gate? A hostile employee is fired the day he returns from a leave of absence. He refuses to vacate the building. He tells his supervisor, "You haven't heard the last of me," and then recites the supervisor's home address. He says, "I'll be visiting you with my buddies, Smith and Wesson." Security guards are called to remove him, and the following morning, his supervisor's car windshield is smashed. Is this fired employee likely to A, send a check for repair of the windshield, B, enroll the next day in medical school, C, start making late-night hang-up calls to the supervisor's home? A couple of days after the man is fired, his supervisor finds a dead snake in his mailbox at home. Was it placed there by A, a neighborhood prankster, B, a member of the Snake Protective League trying to raise social consciousness, C, the man fired a couple of days before? I've used these obvious examples to demonstrate one of the greatest resources for predicting human behavior. You will rarely fail to place people in the most likely category when you frame the choice between contrasting options. This may seem obvious, but it's a powerful assessment tool. A woman in an underground parking lot is approached by a stranger who offers help loading groceries into her car. She could refine her predictions about the man and enjoy a creative exercise by asking herself, is this man A, a member of a citizen volunteer group whose mission is to patrol underground parking lots in search of women to help? B, the owner of a supermarket chain looking for the star of his next national advertising campaign? C, a guy who has some sexual interest in me? By the time you consciously develop even the first possible category for your multiple choice list, you likely already know the correct answer, and you have already considered the level of immediate hazard intuitively. Intuition, remember, knows more about the situation than we are consciously aware of. In the parking lot, it knows when the woman first saw that man as opposed to when she first registered seeing him. It may know when he first saw her. It may know how many other people are around. It knows about the lighting, about how sound carries here, about her ability to escape or defend herself should she need to, and on and on. Similarly, when assessing the fired employee, intuition knows how long he held on to resentments in the past. It remembers sinister statements he made that were followed by some unsolved vandalism. It recalls his disconcerting story about getting even with a neighbor. The reason for creating three options is that it frees you from the need to be correct. You know that at least two of your options will be wrong, and this freedom from judgment clears a path to intuition. In practice, this turns out to be less an exercise in creativity than an exercise in discovery. What you may think you are making up, you are calling up. Many believe the process of creativity is one of assembling thoughts and concepts, but highly creative people will tell you that the idea, the song, the image, was in them, and their task was to get it out. A process of discovery, not design. This was said most artfully by Michelangelo when asked how he created his famous statue of David. He said, "It is easy. You just chip away the stone that doesn't look like David." Well, you can know it will be a man long before the statue is complete. It's an irony of prediction that if you just wait long enough to commit, every prediction will be accurate. By the 11th hour, most factors are apparent, and they are less likely to change because there is less opportunity for intervening influences. The key is to complete a prediction far enough in advance to get some benefit. In other words, while you still have time to prepare or to influence outcome. Why, after all, do we make any prediction? To avoid an outcome or exploit an outcome? To do either, prediction must be followed by preparation. Prediction without preparation is just curiosity. Predicting that Lucky Dancer will run fastest is only valuable when you have time to exploit the outcome by placing a bet at the racetrack. Conversely, if you're standing in the path of the galloping horse, you use the same prediction to avoid the outcome of being trampled, and you get out of the way. The amount of preparation appropriate for a given outcome is determined by evaluating the importance of avoiding or exploiting it and the cost and effectiveness of the strategies you'll use. In deciding what preparations or precautions to apply, one also measures the perceived reliability of the prediction. If I predicted that you would be struck by lightning tomorrow and said that I could ensure your safety for $50,000, you wouldn't be interested. Though it's very important to avoid being struck by lightning, the reliability of my prediction is low, and thus the cost is much too high. If, however, a doctor says you need immediate heart transplant surgery or you'll die, the $50,000 cost is suddenly reasonable. The outcome of death is the same with lightning or heart failure, but we perceive the reliability of the medical prediction as much higher. The same process of comparing reliability, importance, cost, and effectiveness, which my office calls the RICE evaluation, is how people go about making many daily decisions. Society makes its precautionary decisions using the same RICE evaluation. Avoiding the assassination of a big city mayor is less important to society than avoiding the assassination of a presidential candidate. That's why we spend more in a week on a presidential candidate's protection than we spend in a year for most mayors. We may consider our prediction that a presidential candidate might be shot to be more accurate than that a mayor might be shot, but it isn't necessarily so. In fact, mayors have been shot more often and more lethally than presidential candidates. When we add governors to the mix, we find that nearly all have official police protection, yet no modern-day governor has ever been killed in office. Two have been shot while in office, but neither because he was governor. George Wallace because he was a presidential candidate, and John Connally because he was in the car when President Kennedy was assassinated. So, though a mayor is more likely to be killed as a result of holding the office, I'm sorry to tell my mayor readers that we care more about avoiding that outcome for governors. With societies, as with individuals, when the RICE evaluation is made irrationally, it's always because of emotion. For example, avoiding the outcome of hijacking is so important around the world that passengers are screened for weapons more than 1 billion times each year. Only a few hundred people are actually arrested on weapons charges, almost none of whom had any intention of hijacking a plane. Ironically, the only deaths associated with airline hijacking in America have occurred since we instituted weapons screening. So, given the effectiveness, we pay a lot to do something that might prevent just a few incidents. We do this because of emotion. Worry, specifically. To be clear, I support screening of airline passengers, but this is as much for the fear-reducing benefits and deterrence as for the actual detecting of weapons. The likelihood of burglary in your area may be remote, but the importance of avoiding it makes the cost of having locks on the door seem reasonable. Some people consider burglary to be more likely, or consider avoiding it more important, so they purchase security systems. Others don't feel that way. Our approaches to caution and precaution all boil down to a personal RICE evaluation. Ask yourself about the reliability of the safety predictions you make in your life, the importance of avoiding a bad outcome, and the cost and effectiveness of available precautions. With those answers, you can decide what resources to apply to personal safety. When you are at imminent risk, Intuition forgets about all this logical thought and just sends the fear signal. You're given the opportunity to react to a prediction that has already been completed by the time it comes into consciousness. These intuitive predictions are involuntary, but often we must make predictions consciously. How can those be improved? Ingmar Bergman said, "Imagine I throw a spear into the dark. That is my intuition. Then I have to send an expedition into the jungle to find the spear. That is my intellect." Simply by throwing the spear, we greatly improve conscious predictions. By nothing more than the act of inquiry, or even curiously wondering about what a person might do, we enter into a conscious alliance with our intuition, an alliance with the self. Logic and judgment may sometimes be reluctant to follow that spear into the jungle, but the concepts in the next chapter should help persuade them. Chapter 6. High-stakes predictions. Once the principle of movement has been supplied, one thing follows on after another without interruption. Aristotle. I recall the case of a man who drove to a hotel near his home and requested a room on the highest floor. Though he had no luggage, he was escorted up to the 18th floor by a bellman. As a tip, he handed over all the money in his pocket, $61. He then asked if there would be paper and a pen in the room. 5 minutes later, he jumped out the window, committing suicide. Was this suicide foreseeable by the reception person who checked him in, or by the bellman? Both had an opportunity to observe the guest's conduct and demeanor, but they were predicting entirely different outcomes. They were answering such questions as, "Can he pay for this room? Is he the authorized user of his credit card? How can I get another tip like that?" The pre-incident indicators for those predictions don't include the ones relevant to suicide, such as, "Why does he have no luggage? Why does a person who lives nearby check into a hotel? Why did he seek a room on a high floor? Why did he want a pen and paper? Why did he give away all the money he had?" People do all these things for differing reasons, of course. The man might have lost his luggage. He might be staying in a hotel even though he lives nearby because his house is being fumigated. But then, wouldn't he have luggage? He might be staying in a hotel because he just had an argument with his wife and ran out too quickly to gather any belongings. He might have requested a room on a high floor for the view, and he might have asked about pen and paper to write a note to someone, his wife. He might have given all his money as a tip because he's generous. A question that could give meaning to his other behavior is, does he appear depressed? But that's not an issue on the minds of hotel staff. While I'm sure some lawyer could make a case for the hotel's liability, the real point is that to consciously predict something, one must know what outcome is being predicted, or see enough pre-incident indicators to bring that possible outcome into consciousness. Here, some Zen wisdom applies. Knowing the question is the first step toward knowing the answer. The language of prediction. If you were surrounded by a pack of unfamiliar dogs that caused you fear, you could have no better companion than Jim Canino. He's an expert in canine behavior who has worked with hundreds of dogs that people considered vicious or unpredictable. Though you and Jim could observe the same actions by a dog, he'd be more likely to recognize the significance of those actions and more likely to accurately predict the dog's behavior. That's because he knows the dog's predictive language. For example, you may believe that a dog that is barking at you is likely to bite you, but Jim knows that barking is simply a call to other dogs. Growling is the signal to respect. In the predictive language of dogs, the growl means, "Nobody's coming, and I have to handle this on my own." When someone speaks to you in a language you don't understand, though you hear the sounds clearly, they carry limited meaning. For instance, look at the following paragraph. Fleeming, Robert Doe, Beward, CCR, L. John, 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 GGS. This may look like gibberish, but your intuition has probably told you it's not. That paragraph contains the names of 6 famous people, but in a slightly different language than the rest of this book. Fleming is Ian Fleming. E-N Fleming. Robert Doe is Robert De Niro. Robert D-Niro. B. Ward is Warren Beatty. War-N-B-D. C-C-R is Caesar. C's R. L. John John John, etc. is Elton John. L. Ten John. G-G-S is Jesus. G's S. These word puzzles show that meaning is often in front of us to be harvested. Sometimes we need only believe it is there. These puzzles show something else, too, something about the differences between intuition and conscious prediction. If the solution to one of these puzzles doesn't come right away, it's then a matter of letting the answer surface in you. Because stare though you may, there's no additional information forthcoming from the puzzle itself. If you solve one, the answer was available in you somewhere. Many people resist this idea, believing that they solve the puzzles by moving the letters around and trying them in different order, as if they were anagrams. But they're not anagrams, and they have no consistent rules, and people often get them immediately without having the time to figure them out. I show a series of these intuitive puzzles when I give speeches and ask audience members to call out the answers as they come to them. Most of the correct answers, sometimes nearly all of them, come from women. It's also so that most of the incorrect answers come from women. That's because women are willing to call out what comes to them. They're willing to guess. The men, conversely, won't risk being wrong in front of a room full of people, so they won't call out an answer until they're sure it's correct. The result is that while each man is plodding through his personal logic test for each puzzle, the women have called out all the answers. Women are more comfortable relying on intuition because they do it all the time. Intuition is just listening. Prediction is more like trying to solve the puzzles with logic. You may have greater confidence in conscious predictions because you can show yourself the methodology you used, but that doesn't necessarily increase their accuracy. Even though this is a chapter about improving conscious predictions, don't believe for a moment that when it comes to human behavior, the conscious predictions are any better than the unconscious ones. We predict the behavior of other human beings based on our ability to read certain signals that we recognized. In Desmond Morris's Body Talk, he describes the meaning of gestures and body movements and notes in which parts of the world various meanings apply. Amazingly, 66 of the signals are listed as being valid worldwide, universal to all human beings in every culture on Earth. The majority of them are presented unconsciously. Everywhere in the world, the chin jutted forward is a sign of aggression. The head slightly retracted is a sign of fear. The nostrils flared while taking a sharp breath is a sign of anger. If a person anywhere on the planet holds his arms forward with the palms facing down while making small downward movements, he means calm down. In every culture, stroking the chin means I am thinking. Just as these movements are unconscious, so is our reading of them, usually unconscious. If I ask you to list just 15 of the 66 worldwide gestures or physical movements, you'd find it difficult. But you absolutely know them all and respond to each intuitively. Earlier I mentioned the predictive language of dogs, which is all nonverbal. Desmond Morris has identified one of the nonverbal parts of human language, but we have many others. Often knowing the language of a given prediction is more important than understanding exactly what a person says. The key is understanding the meaning and the perspective beneath and behind the words people choose. When predicting violence, some of the languages include the language of rejection, the language of entitlement, the language of grandiosity, the language of attention-seeking, the language of revenge, the language of attachment, the language of identity-seeking. Attention-seeking, grandiosity, entitlement, and rejection are often linked. Think of someone you know who's always in need of attention, who can't bear to be alone or to be unheard. Few people like being ignored, of course, but to this person, it will have a far greater meaning. Imagine Al Sharpton or Rush Limbaugh unable to garner attention by the methods they do today. Believing they deserve it, entitlement and grandiosity, knowing they need it, fear of rejection, and committed to being seen and listened to, attention-seeking, they might strongly resist a loss of audience. If the need in them is great enough, and you be the judge, they might do some pretty extreme things to draw interest. Think of a person you know whose self-evaluation is lofty or grandiose, perhaps even with good reason. When he volunteers for something and later learns that he wasn't chosen or wasn't even seriously considered, the news will have a different meaning to him than it would to a modest, humble person. Such a person might also feel humiliated more quickly than a modest person. In each prediction about violence, we must ask what the context, stimuli, and developments might mean to the person involved, not just what they mean to us. We must ask if the actor will perceive violence as moving him towards some desired outcome or away from it. The conscious or unconscious decision to use violence, or to do most anything, involves many mental and emotional processes. But they usually boil down to how a person perceives four fairly simple issues: justification, alternatives, consequences, and ability. My office abbreviates these elements as JACA, and an evaluation of them helps predict violence. Perceived justification, J. Does the person feel justified in using violence? Perceived justification can be as simple as being sufficiently provoked. Hey, you stepped on my foot. Or as convoluted as looking for an excuse to argue, as with the spouse that starts a disagreement in order to justify an angry response. The process of developing and manufacturing justification can be observed. A person who is seeking to feel justification for some action might move from, "What you've done angers me," to, "What you've done is wrong." Popular justifications include the moral high ground of righteous indignation, and the more simple equation, known by its biblical name, an eye for an eye. Anger is a very seductive emotion, because it's profoundly energizing and exhilarating. Sometimes people feel their anger is justified by past unfairnesses, and with the slightest excuse, they bring forth resentments unrelated to the present situation. You could say such a person has pre-justified hostility, more commonly known as having a chip on his shoulder. The degree of provocation is, of course, in the eye of the provoked. John Monahan notes that how a person appraises an event may have a great influence on whether he or she ultimately responds to it in a violent manner. What he calls perceived intentionality, e.g., "You didn't just bump into me, you meant to hit me," is perhaps the clearest example of a person looking for justification. Perceived alternatives, A. Does the person perceive that he has available alternatives to violence that will move him toward the outcome he wants? Since violence, like any behavior, has a purpose, it's valuable to know the goal of the actor. For example, if a person wants his job back, violence is not the most effective strategy, since it precludes the very outcome he seeks. Conversely, if he wants revenge, violence is a viable strategy, though usually not the only one. Alternatives to violence might be ridicule, smear campaigns, lawsuits, or inflicting some other non-physical harm on the targeted person or organization. Knowing the desired outcome is the key. If a person's desired outcome is to inflict physical injury, then there are few alternatives to violence. If the desired outcome is to punish someone, there might be many. It's when he perceives no alternatives that violence is most likely. David wouldn't have fought Goliath if he had perceived alternatives. Justification alone wouldn't have been enough to compensate for his low ability to prevail over his adversary. More than anything, he fought because he had no choice. A person, or an animal, who feels there are no alternatives, will fight even when violence isn't justified, even when the consequences are perceived as unfavorable, and even when the ability to prevail is low. Perceived consequences. C. How does the person view the consequences associated with using violence? Before resorting to force, people weigh the likely consequences, even if unconsciously or very quickly. Consequences might be intolerable, such as for a person whose identity and self-image would be too damaged if he used violence. Context can change that, as with a person who is normally passive but becomes violent in a crowd or mob. Violence can be made tolerable by the support or encouragement of others. It's when consequences are perceived as favorable, such as for an assassin who wants attention and has little to lose, that violence is likely. Perceived ability, A. Does the person believe he can successfully deliver the blows or bullet or bomb? People who have successfully used violence in the past have a higher appraisal of their ability to prevail using violence again. People with weapons or other advantages perceive, often correctly, a high ability to use violence. To see the Jaka elements in practice on a large scale, look at world conflict. The Palestinians have the goal of reclaiming and protecting their land rights. Some also have the goal of avenging past wrongs and punishing the Israelis. In either case, those who bring violence to the issue feel justified in doing so. They perceive no alternatives that will move them toward their goals as effectively as violence. They view the consequences of violence as favorable. Pressure on the Israelis, world attention to their plight, vengeance for past suffering, etc. They perceive a high ability to deliver violence, by now with good reason. To predict whether the Palestinians will continue to use violence, we must, at least for the purposes of evaluation, see the issues their way. The importance of seeing things from the perspective of the person whose behavior you are predicting cannot be overstated. A recent 60 Minutes show gave a good example of most people's reluctance to do that. It profiled the mastermind terrorist known as the Engineer, a man who helped kamikaze martyrs strap explosives to their chests. His agents became walking bombs, carrying death into populated areas. Interviewer Steve Croft asked one of the Engineer's terrorist followers to describe the man who could do such terrible things. The answer? He's a very normal person, just like all of us. Croft took exception. You said that he's just like all the rest of us. I would say that no one would consider you and him normal. The terrorist replied, I believe your statement is incorrect. There are thousands and thousands in our country that believe what we believe, and not only our country, in the rest of the Arab world and even in your country. The terrorist was right. Jaka elements can be observed in governments just as with individuals. When America is preparing to go to war, justification is first. Evil empire, mad dictator, international outlaw, protect our interests, cannot just stand by and watch, etc. Alternatives to violence shrink as we move from negotiations to demands, warnings to boycotts, and finally, blockades to attacks. The perceived consequences of going to war move from intolerable to tolerable as public opinion comes into alignment with government opinion. Our appraisal of our ability rises as ships and troops are moved into proximity of an enemy. At the end of the day, the American bomber who kills 100 people in Iraq decides to use violence the same way as the Palestinian bomber who kills 100 people in Israel. This idea may bother some readers, but as was discussed in Chapter 3, effective predictions require that we not make value judgments. Instead, we must see the battle, at least for a moment, from the deck of the enemy warship, because each person has his own perspective, his own reality, no matter how much it may differ from ours. As historian James Burke explains, all that can accurately be said about a man who thinks he is a poached egg is that he is in the minority. The elements of prediction. There is a way to evaluate the likelihood of success of any prediction, a way to predict the prediction, so to speak. It can be done by measuring 11 elements. These elements, which I am offering here as a glimpse into some of the strategies used by my firm, apply to every type of prediction, not just those involving violence. I know how universal they are, for many corporate clients whom we have advised on high-stakes predictions have asked us to assist on other types of predictions, such as what opposing litigants might do. We start by answering the following questions. 1. Measurability of outcome. How measurable is the outcome you seek to predict? Will it be clear if it happens or does not happen? For example, imagine the predictive question is, will a bomb explode in the auditorium during the pro-choice rally? That outcome is measurable, i.e., it would be obvious if it happened. If, however, the predictive question is, will we have a good time on an upcoming trip to Hawaii, we might not have a shared definition of good time. My having a good time might not be obvious to you and might not be easily discoverable. Thus, the prediction is less likely to succeed than those with outcomes that are easily measurable. 2. Vantage. Is the person making the prediction in a position to observe the pre-incident indicators and context? For example, to predict what will happen between two quarreling people, it's valuable to have a vantage point from which you can see and hear them. 3. Imminence. Are you predicting an outcome that might occur soon, as opposed to some remote time in the future? Ideally, one predicts outcomes that will happen while they're still significant. Will someone attempt to harm Senator Smith next week is an easier predictive question to answer successfully than, will someone attempt to harm Senator Smith in 30 years? Success is more likely for the first question because conditions next week will not be affected by as many intervening influences as conditions in 30 years will. Our best predictive resources are applied when outcomes might occur while they are still meaningful to us. Though perhaps harsh to Senator Smith, it might not matter much to people today if he is harmed in 30 years. There is a similar dynamic with more personal predictive questions, such as, will smoking kill me? Smokers can easily predict that it will likely kill them, but the outcome is so remote in time that it loses much of its significance. 4. Context. Is the context of the situation clear to the person making the prediction? Is it possible to evaluate the attendant conditions and circumstances, the relationships of parties and events to each other? 5. Pre-incident indicators, PINs. Are there detectable pre-incident indicators that will reliably occur before the outcome being predicted? This is the most valuable of the elements. If one were predicting whether a governor might be the object of an assassination attempt at a speech, pre-incident indicators would include the assassins jumping on stage with a gun. But that is too recent a pin to be very useful, as it provides little time for intervention. The birth of the assassin is also a pin, but it is too dated to be valuable. Even though both of these events are critical intersections on the map of this particular prediction, one hopes to be somewhere between the two, between the earliest possible detectable factor and those that occur an instant before the act. Useful pins for assassination might include the assassins trying to learn the governor's schedule, developing a plan, purchasing a weapon, keeping a diary, or telling people something big is coming. Ideally, an outcome would be preceded by several reliable pins. But they must also be detectable. Someone's getting the idea to kill and making the decision to kill are both extraordinarily valuable pins. But since these occur in the mind, they might not be detectable on their own. Later I'll discuss the pins for workplace violence, spousal killings, homicides by children, and public figure attack. They are always there, though not always known to the people making the predictions. 6. Experience. Does the person making the prediction have experience with the specific topic involved? A lion tamer can predict whether or not a lion will attack more accurately than I can because he has experience. He can do an even better job if he has experience with both possible outcomes, lions that do not attack and lions that do. 7. Comparable events. Can you study or consider outcomes that are comparable, though not necessarily identical, to the one being predicted? Ideally, one relies on events that are substantively comparable. Predicting whether a senator will be shot by a mentally ill member of the general public, one might study cases in which mayors were shot by deranged pursuers, as this is substantively the same situation, and the relationship between the players is similar. One can learn about the pins in the mayor cases and consider whether they apply to the present prediction. On the other hand, studying cases of senators shot by their spouses or senators who shot themselves would not likely improve the success of a prediction about a stranger shooting a senator. 8. Objectivity. Is the person making the prediction objective enough to believe that either outcome is possible? People who believe only one outcome is possible have already completed their prediction. With the simple decision to make a decision before the full range of predictive tests has been completed, they have hit the wall of their intuitive ability. Asked to predict whether a given employee will act violently, the person who believes that kind of thing never happens is not the right choice for the job. People only apply all their predictive resources when they believe either outcome is possible. 9. Investment. To what degree is the person making the prediction invested in the outcome? Simply put, how much does he or she care about avoiding or exploiting the outcome? Does he or she have reason to want the prediction to be correct? If I ask you right now to predict whether I will oversleep tomorrow, you won't bring your best predictive resources to the question because you don't care. If, however, you're relying on me to pick you up at the airport early tomorrow morning, your prediction will be far better. 10. Replicability. Is it practical to test the exact issue being predicted by trying it first elsewhere? Asked to predict if water in a pot will boil when heated, you need not heat this water to improve the prediction. You can test the issue, replicate it exactly by heating other water first. It is a low-cost experiment for a low-stakes prediction. While replicability is the cornerstone of most scientific predictions, it is nearly useless in high-stakes predictions of human behavior. I can't test whether an angry employee will shoot a supervisor by giving him a gun and watching him at work. 11. Knowledge. Does the person making the prediction have accurate knowledge about the topic? Unless it's relevant and accurate, knowledge can be the sinking ship the fool insists is seaworthy, because knowledge often masquerades as wisdom. If a corporate executive has knowledge that most perpetrators of workplace violence are white males between 35 and 50 years old, he might ignore someone's bizarre behavior because the employee does not fit the profile. In my firm, we use a predictive instrument that assigns point values to each of these 11 elements. The most advanced concept of prediction has to do with deciding just when it is that a thing starts to happen. The prediction of earthquakes gives us an extreme example. There are, contrary to popular belief, reliable pre-incident indicators for earthquakes. The problem is that the pins might be 10,000 years long, and for this reason, earthquakes remain, in human terms, unpredictable. In geological terms, however, it's fair to say that the next earthquake in Los Angeles has already started. In geology, calling something a catastrophe means only that the event occurs in a time period short enough to be meaningful to man. The Earth's moving is not the issue, because the ground you are on right now is moving. The suddenness is the issue. In predicting violence, a pre-incident indicator that takes a long time begs the question of whether we need to wait until something becomes a catastrophe versus trying to detect it at a midway mark. Does an assassination attempt begin when the gun is fired at the victim, or when it's drawn, or when it's carried into the arena, or when it's loaded, or when it's purchased, or when assassination is first thought of. Prediction moves from a science to an art when you realize that pre-incident indicators are actually part of the incident. When you apply this concept to human beings, you can see that behavior is like a chain. Too often, we look at just the individual links. When we ask why a man committed suicide, someone might say, he was despondent over major financial losses, as if this could possibly explain it. Many people are despondent over financial losses and don't kill themselves. Though we want to believe that violence is a matter of cause and effect, it's actually a process, a chain in which the violent outcome is only one link. If you were predicting what a friend of yours might do if he lost his job, you wouldn't say, oh, he'll commit suicide, unless there were many other pins of suicide present. You'd see the loss of his job as a single link, not the whole chain. The process of suicide starts way before the act of suicide. The same is true for homicide. Though we might try to explain a murder using simple cause and effect logic, e.g., he learned his wife was having an affair, so he killed her. It doesn't aid prediction to think this way. Like the earthquake, violence is one outcome of a process that started way before this man got married. By this point, you've read a lot about successful predictions, more perhaps than can easily be recalled. Still, there's no need for a memory test because the information is already in your mind. I know that because it came from your mind in the first place. These elements of prediction are the same ones our ancestors relied on to survive. If they seem new to you, it's because they've been largely ignored by modern Westerners. We perceive less need for them because we are now at a point in our evolution where life is less about predicting risks and more about controlling them. Endowed with great intellect, with which to protect ourselves, we've developed extraordinary technologies for survival. Chief among them is modern medicine. Though we're no less vulnerable to injury, we are far less likely to die from it. Technology has also provided the ability to call for help, so we rarely feel isolated in an emergency. We also have rapid transportation that can rush us to medical care, or rush it to us. Even with all this, we have more fear today than ever before, and most of it is fear of each other. To be as free from it as possible, we need to recapture our inherent predictive skills. In the following chapters, the elements of prediction and intuition that I've discussed will come together in practice. You'll see that just as hearing intuition is no more than reading the signals we give ourselves, predicting human behavior is no more than reading the signals others give us. Chapter 7. Promises to Kill. Man is a coward, plain and simple. He loves life too much. He fears others too much. Jack Henry Abbott. I am going to kill you. These six words may have triggered more high-stakes predictions than any other sentence ever spoken. They've certainly caused a great deal of fear and anxiety. But why? Perhaps we believe only a deranged and dangerous person would even think of harming us. But that just isn't so. Plenty of people have thought of harming you. The driver of the car behind you, who felt you were going too slowly. The person waiting to use the payphone you were chatting on. The person you fired, the person you walked out on. They have all hosted a fleeting, violent idea. Though thoughts of harming you may be terrible, they are also inevitable. The thought is not the problem. The expression of the thought is what causes us anxiety. And most of the time, that's the whole idea. Understanding this will help reduce unwarranted fear. That someone would intrude on our peace of mind, that they would speak words so difficult to take back, that they would exploit our fear, that they would care so little about us, that they would raise the stakes so high, that they would stoop so low, all of this alarms us, and by design. Threatening words are dispatched like soldiers under strict orders. Cause anxiety that cannot be ignored. Surprisingly, their deployment isn't entirely bad news. It's bad, of course, that someone threatens violence, but the threat means that at least for now, he has considered violence and decided against doing it. The threat means that at least for now, and usually forever, he favors words that alarm over actions that harm. For an instrument of communication used so frequently, the threat is little understood until you think about it. The parent who threatens punishment, the lawyer who threatens unspecified further action, the head of state who threatens war, the ex-husband who threatens murder, the child who threatens to make a scene, all are using words with the exact same intent, to cause uncertainty. Our social world relies on our investing some threats with credibility while discounting others. Our belief that they will really tow the car if we leave it here encourages us to look for a parking space unencumbered by that particular threat. The disbelief that our joking spouse will really kill us if we're late to dinner allows us to stay in the marriage. Threats, you see, are not the issue. Context is the issue. For example, as you watch two people argue, an escalation of hostility that would otherwise cause alarm causes none if it's happening between actors on stage at the theater. Conversely, behavior that is normally not threatening, such as a man walking up some stairs, becomes alarming when it's an uninvited audience member marching up onto that same stage. It is context that gives meaning to the few steps he takes. A single word between intimates, perhaps meaningless to others, might carry a strong message of love or threat, depending on context. Context is the necessary link that gives meaning to everything we observe. Imagine a man arriving for work one morning. He doesn't go in the unlocked front door where most people enter the building, but instead goes around to a back entrance. When he sees someone ahead of him use a key to get in, he runs up and catches the door before it relocks. Once he's inside the building, he barely responds as a co-worker calls out, "The boss wants to see you." "Yeah, I want to see him too," the man says quietly. He's carrying a gym bag, but it appears too heavy to contain just clothes. Before going to his boss's office, he stops in the locker room, reaches into the bag, and pulls out a pistol. He takes a second handgun from the bag and conceals both of them beneath his coat. Now, he looks for his boss. If we stopped right here and you had to predict this man's likely behavior on the basis of what you know, context would tell the tale. Because to know just one thing changes every other thing. This man is a police detective. If he were a postal worker, your prediction would be different. Though knowing context is the key to predicting which threats will be acted upon, people are often reluctant to put it ahead of content. Even some experts believe that threat assessments are aided by identifying and considering so-called key words. The assumption is that these words are significant by their presence alone, but the practice is rarely enlightening. As a person creates a communication, his selection of words is part of that creation. But they're instruments, not the final product. Look at this list of words. Skin, rip, peel, warning, blood, kill, mutilated, bomb. A key word enthusiast would enjoy plenty of alarm from a single paragraph containing kill, blood, and bomb, but you decide if the final product merits concern. The whole car trip I was cold right down to my skin. The wind would rip along so hard I thought it would peel the roof off. And here's a warning, don't ever travel with relatives. Blood may be thicker than water, but trying to kill time listening to Uncle Harry's mutilated jokes bomb was just too much. Conversely, look at this list of words and the context in which they appear. Tidy, pretty, flowers, beautiful, welcome. Tidy up your affairs and buy some pretty flowers, because God has ordered me to take you to his beautiful place. where he is anxious to welcome you. Here is a letter I once assessed for a client. As I walked with you yesterday, the sheer grace of your body thrilled me. Your beauty gives me a starting point for appreciating all other beauty, in a flower or a stream. I sometimes cannot tell where you let off and the beauty of nature begins, and all I want is to feel your body and share my love with you. It is context that makes the prose in this letter so alarming. It was written by a 50-year-old man to a 10-year-old daughter of a neighbor. The man moved soon after we interviewed him. He's now in prison for a predictable offense, repeatedly propositioning an underage girl to have sex with him. The phone message, "Hi, honey, it's me," might, all by itself, communicate a terrible threat if it's the voice of an ex-husband whom a woman has tried to avoid by fleeing to another state and changing her name. As I said, context is much more important to predictions than content, and this truth relates to safety in some significant ways. For example, as I write this, I am in Fiji, where from time to time a person is killed by something most of us don't consider dangerous, a coconut. Given that the trees are often very tall and the coconuts very large, if one falls on you, the impact is comparable to having a bowling ball dropped on your head from the roof of a 5-story building. Are there ways to see the coconut hazard coming? Absolutely. There are many. But to detect them would involve evaluating all the factors that influence a coconut's readiness to fall. I might have to climb the tree, test the stem strength, consider such things as the moistness and density of the fiber, the weight of the coconut, etc. I could measure the wind velocity and the rate at which similarly ripened coconuts have recently fallen from nearby trees. Ultimately, however, there's just one practical pre-incident indicator. It's the sound of a coconut falling through dried bark or leaves. Most of the time, this warning comes much too late to exploit. In other words, it could be the last sound one hears. So is there a way to avoid this lethal outcome? Yes, there is. But I needn't sit at the base of a tree contemplating the question as a coconut rushes downward toward my skull. Since the outcome only happens in the very limited context of being under a coconut tree, I can avoid the hazard altogether, simply by sitting elsewhere. Similarly, we can avoid risks that are inherently present in certain situations. We need not walk defiantly through the territory of a violent gang, or wear our Rolex on a trip to Rio, or stay in a violent relationship. Context can be a useful predictor of hazard all by itself. Context can also be a reliable guarantor of safety. Teaching a criminal justice class at George Washington University, I asked 5 of the students to think up the most frightening, convincing death threats they could and then deliver them to me. I would assess and then accurately determine the seriousness of each one. The first student I called on stood up and said matter-of-factly, "It's ironic that you would have this exercise tonight, and I can't believe you chose me to go first, because I actually have been planning to kill you. When I saw on the schedule that you were teaching tonight, I borrowed, well, took my brother's pistol. I have it here in my briefcase." He held up the case and tilted it from side to side so we could hear that it did indeed contain something heavy. "I first planned to shoot you as you walked to your car, but I've decided to do it here in the classroom. Given the topic of the class and the fact that you are an expert on threats, this shooting will intrigue people and bring me attention for a long while." He looked around at the other students, some of whom were a bit uncomfortable. "If anyone wants to avoid seeing this, you should leave right now." As he reached slowly into his briefcase, I called out, "Next threat," and he sat down. I had told the class I'd be able to predict the seriousness and outcome of each threat with perfect reliability, and I did. That's because it made no difference what they said or how they said it, since I had asked the students to threaten me. Context, not content, dictated the obvious. None of the threats would be acted upon. Still, because most people have had little experience with death threats, and because they mistakenly believe that the death threat is inherently different from all other threats, the words usually cause undue fear. In fact, the death threat is among the threats least likely to be carried out. The first step toward deciding which words actually portend danger is understanding what threats are and what they are not. A threat is a statement of an intention to do some harm, period. It offers no conditions, no alternatives, no ways out. It does not contain the words if, or else, until, unless. Sentences that do contain those words are not threats, they are intimidations, and there is an important distinction. Intimidations are statements of conditions to be met in order to avert a harm. For example, "I will burn this building down if I don't get the promotion," is an intimidation, not a threat, because a condition is offered to avert the harm. With intimidations, the motive is always right in the statement, and the outcome the speaker desires is clear. "Unless you apologize, I'll kill you." The speaker wants an apology. "If you fire me, you'll be sorry." The speaker wants to keep his job. These statements differ importantly from threats because they're brought into play as high-stakes manipulations. The speaker wants his conditions met. He doesn't want to inflict the harm. With threats, conversely, no conditions are offered, usually because the speaker sees few alternatives. Thus, threats carry more likelihood of violence than intimidations. Another tip: threats that are endgame moves, those introduced late in a controversy, are more serious than those used early. That's because those used early likely represent an immediate emotional response as opposed to a decision to use violence. As an instrument of communication, the threat is most similar to the promise, though promises are kept far more often. With a promise, if we judge that the speaker is sincere, we next assess the likelihood that he will retain his will over time. One may promise something today but feel different tomorrow. Because threats are often spoken from emotion, and because emotions are ephemeral, threateners often lose their will over time. Threats and promises alike are easy to speak, harder to honor. Both promises and threats are made to convince us of an intention, but threats actually convince us of an emotion: frustration. Threats betray the speaker by proving that he has failed to influence events in any other way. Most often they represent desperation, not intention. Neither threats nor promises are guarantees, contracts, or even commitments. They are just words. Guarantees offer to set things right if the promise isn't kept. With contracts, there is some cost for breaches of the promise. People making commitments